just want to say something about the course and what this is tonight. This is introductory for the course that I'll be offering that starts a week from tomorrow, called Experiential Mindfulness and an Introduction to Self-Leadership. And the goal of the class is to give you a guided tour of your mind that I'd be willing to bet a lot of you haven't had before. This kind of tour, at least what we'll be doing in the class, is where you're actually going to be the tour guide. I'll be giving you a new kind of map, so to speak, called self-leadership. I'll give instructions and guidance, demonstrations about how to follow that map. The map, which in this case is the concept and the ideas of self-leadership, will redefine how you think of yourself. At least that's the theory, and that's many people's experience with this. You won't need complicated analysis, psyche. You won't need to know what went right in your childhood or what didn't go right in childhood. You won't have to have the right answer about how to reframe your negative thinking or anything like that. You're really going to be taught how to interact with the landscape of your mind, the texture of your mind, and your mind will actually teach you what path to take. So for some of you, that may sound really strange and kind of far out there, but there's a lot of nuts and bolts, and I hope to be able to give you some practical explanation of exactly what that means when I say something like that this approach is a little bit like when authors or people who, you know, famous authors or, you know, kind of geniuses in their creative geniuses will say something like, well, the book wrote me, I didn't write the book. And in this sense, this is a kind of inner exploration of yourself where your mind will be teaching you, which is actually possible. You'll be listening to a form of intelligence that we all have, but we walk around most of the time unaware that this is available to us. So self-leadership is a way to access that form of intelligence anytime you focus on it, or if you choose to build a lifestyle where you've practiced this and it's more readily available to you. So just before we go further, I want to make sure that's what people are here to hear about. Does that sound like you're in the right place? Anybody out there?
Yes.
Okay, good. Everybody's in the right place, I will assume, or your microphones are muted. So I'm going to talk about, let me just say something about myself, first of all. I know some of you on this call, some of you I don't know. I'm trained as a social worker. I'm a psychotherapist in private practice, and I run a counseling business, Keith Miller Counseling and Associates, DuPont Circle in Bethesda. And before I was a psychotherapist, I was a social worker. Before I was a social worker, I was being trained to be in ministry and actually studying to be a pastor. One of the things that that really hooked me as I was beginning to go into ministry was the idea of how complex our brains are and our minds. And that fascinated me, and so it actually took me on a radically different, not radically different, but a different path from ministry into the art of and science of psychotherapy. One of my specialties is working with couples, and I've been fascinated by the complexity of couples as well. It's kind of the way that I think hikers get fascinated with Mount Everest, because it's the hardest type of psychotherapy and the most complex type of psychology between two people. So that's a little bit about my background and what I spend my day doing. Certified internal family systems therapist, which is something I use in my work frequently. And self-leadership, which is what this course is going to be teaching you about, is based on the psychotherapy of internal family systems therapy. So when I might use the terms interchangeably tonight, to say self-leadership or IFS, internal family systems. So that's really what I'm talking about. And by the way, the term internal family systems therapy is not anything to do with family therapy, which is a little weird, frankly. But the reason it's named that is the person that created this work is a family therapist and was discovering basically how parts of individuals within the psyche behave much like family members in a real family. And he used the interventions that would typically be used between two people or a group of people. For example, when a person starts talking and everybody else starts talking and interrupts, family therapist would say, and this is common sense, would say, well, you know, I can't hear you, so could only one person talk from now on? Simple things like that. But strategically, he applied interventions that were used in family therapy for an individual to get them to focus on just one part of them at a time so that other parts of their psyche weren't interrupting, be more clear. So that's just a little bit of background about the term and the name, IFS, Internal Family Systems Therapy. The reason I do this course is I offer, like I said, I do this work with people in therapy all the time. And frankly, it's to me, it's a revolutionary kind of psychotherapy. It's in one of these, it's a model that's transformed my practice from one being trained as a very practical behavioral type of in a behavioral type of psychology to one that is more experiential, like self-leadership. It's a lot of people have the counter with this sort of work and say, you know, I wish I had found this type of thing before. I've done therapy for many years, but this is radically different than anything I've done and far more effective. And I don't think I'm understating that when people encounter this. It's not for everybody, and we'll get to some of the reasons for that in a little bit. But people that do understand the concepts here recognize immediately how powerful this is and how transformative it can be. So that's one of the things that the reason I do this is to offer that at a more in a more educational setting so that you don't have to be necessarily the focus of the work all the time as you would be in psychotherapy. And some people, that's just not for them. And frankly, my own experience studying and learning this method and making it part of my lifestyle didn't come from just psychotherapy, even though that's a big part of my own learning. It's come from watching other people do it and struggle with it over a period of years of training and learning the material didactically, intellectually, which I think frees people up, at least in my case. I tend to be very skeptical about, in particular, this type of thing, which is more experiential and less based on thinking or rational thought. So naturally, I was very skeptical until I could learn the underpinnings of it and the basis. And so I'll talk a little bit during the call tonight about some of the neurobiological basis for this. But just to say, in general, the course is not necessarily going to be a lecture on neurobiology, but there is a strong basis for it. And one that actually in the last 10 years in neurobiology has been validated and confirmed and actually turning on its head a lot of what we know about the brain and plasticity and the brain's ability to change itself. So IFS, even though when it was formed 20 years ago by Richard Schwartz, Dick Schwartz does not operationalize the neurobiology of the method, but nonetheless, the field of neuroscience is catching up, or one way to put it, I guess Dick has caught up to that, and it's meshing together in a very interesting way. So this is an operational way to create change in your brain. I mentioned the idea of having a family of parts inside of us. And one of the things that Dick noticed, you know, he was working with a population of people who had serious trauma and eating disorders and suicidal tendencies. And so some of the things that, these are some of the things that sometimes scare people. He was working, as he was listening to his clients, he realized that some of the changes he was making should have been helping them but weren't. So, for example, they would be making changes in their family structure that would get them out of the role that they were in that may have been causing the symptoms, but the symptoms still persisted. So he did something really interesting for a therapist, which is he really listened to his clients. He started hearing many of his clients say, well, you know, there's a part of me that wants to eat this bag of candy and just binge on it all night. There's another part of me that wants to be healthy and thinks that's totally disgusting. And so he would get curious about that, and he would start to do these interventions where he would ask the client to ask one of those parts to step aside and just listen to one at a time. And an interesting thing would start to happen. The client, the person would begin to feel more relaxed. The anxiety, the depression, the kind of dangerous symptoms would all of a sudden be gone. And the person would more or less be in a state, and he would report this to be almost universal. He wasn't prompting them. They'd be in a state that he would report as being very compassionate, very confident, curious, very flexible, calm. A lot of the people reported it being kind of a spiritual state, even though they weren't necessarily spiritual people, but they all reported that it felt like a spiritual kind of state that they were in. And what Dick was doing actually was nothing new. It's not as though he was discovering this concept. It's a concept which we call natural multiplicity, which predates Dick Schwartz and predates all of us, actually. It's embedded in many of the ancient forms of religion, at least the mystical versions of the major religions, where the focus is inward. The focus is on the person being contemplative and going inside, and people would report having these types of experiences. But what was new, and what Dick Schwartz was doing that was new and I think radical actually, is that he was operationalizing the steps. He was making this user-friendly and interactive so that a person could learn how to access this central core, a kind of spiritual core, which he just termed the self. Some people, that term doesn't really mean much to them. Some people prefer to call it the soul. But nonetheless, it's this spiritual core that when the parts are the parts of our personality step aside, there is actually something there. And it's not just nothingness. We have this clear and compassionate center that can be very active, unlike forms of meditation, which seek to kind of get to that zone or kind of a flow state neurologically. They do that by moving aside distractions. And even though Dick was doing the same type of thing by getting parts to relax, he was actually getting the client to interact with the parts, and they would begin to relax spontaneously. So when you approach yourself and these parts of you with compassion, with curiosity, then parts of you that are active or maybe exhibiting symptoms start to transform and become different. They're not exactly what they appear to be at first. So the concept of self is much like what we think of as an orchestra conductor, where it can be an active type of energy, not just a sitting and breathing and focusing on the rhythm of your breathing, which is common in meditation and generating the relaxation response neurologically. In the IFS, in self-leadership, we generate a similar kind of relaxed meditative state, but the mind can be extremely active, and that's in contrast to meditation. In fact, you can do some of your best processing of emotions and of thoughts in this kind of relaxed state. So that's what we teach you how to do in self-leadership. So just want to go over a couple of the benefits about learning about yourself in this kind of state when you can learn self-leadership. Much of what we know about ourselves is actually based on a really narrow band of information because we're constantly blended with parts of us. And when I refer to parts, I should probably explain what I'm talking about. We all have parts. There's nothing wrong with parts. And neurologically, what we're speaking about is a mind and body state, or a mind and or body state, I should say, that has a preset agenda, and it's kind of memorized, and it's a closed circuit. So it's something that got learned. It's a response that we learned how to do. We memorized it, and it's tucked away. It's indexed in our brain, in the part of our brain that specifically we don't need to think about anymore, the unconscious. So parts are mostly unconscious. We're not aware of them. They can run on autopilot. And that's a good thing, actually. We need this to happen. Otherwise, we'd be incredibly simple-minded people and not able to multitask and do the incredible things that our brain can do processing at one time. So parts could be described as a feeling, also a body state, or a thought. And a lot of people will think of sometimes thoughts as voices. You can sometimes hear it. So it sounds like a voice. We're not talking about pathology here. We're talking about this is natural and normal multiplicity. Or a part could be something that we see in our mind's eye. So it could be like a memory or a vision, something that may be in the future. And the nomenclature, at least when we start to get into different parts, there's no real limit to number of parts. And we form parts all the time. It's not as though we form these in childhood and have a preset version of parts. Parts of us are constantly shifting and growing and transforming, and they often get into battles with each other, and that's usually where we'll experience anxiety or depression or any number of symptoms that are in the DSM-4. So when we're thinking about the psyche from this level of complexity, the symptoms actually emerge not from any one part of us, but between the parts. So it's the interaction of one part pulling on and trying to coerce and change the other. Like I mentioned earlier, the part of me that wants to be skinny, the part of me that wants to eat this bag of Doritos or whatever. Just to give an example, would it be useful to give an example of parts? Anybody still there?
Yes.
So common type of part that we encounter, just to give you an example, like maybe a person says, I'm depressed. Well, when we look at that more closely and when we start to use the language of parts, we actually start to see there's more to it than just a depression. There's often a part that feels, the depression itself may be just a kind of low energy or a low motivation. And what's layered into that is another part. There's often a part that may be really ashamed about feeling low energy. It's not who they think of themselves as being. So there's a part that's kind of feeling bad about having this low energy. So that actually compounds the lower energy. And then on top of that, there's a part that's trying to change it, and maybe a part that says, I've got to fix this and got to do something about it. So it's kind of a taskmaster, like, what can I do to fix this? So that's just an example of three different parts. And the activity of one stimulates the activity of the other. It's a system. And so what we do in self-leadership is we begin to look at the parts one at a time, using this kind of compassionate and curious approach and kind of attitude with the parts. So we don't judge them. We kind of listen to them. We're compassionate, but we also don't let the parts take over. Like an orchestra conductor, when we're leading from our true self, we actually, you know, like a good orchestra conductor will be understanding and intimately acquainted with each of the members, each of the parts of the orchestra, and will value them. At the same time, he or she doesn't take sides with the horn section, or doesn't think that, you know, just because the violinist is really attractive that she should get all the great pieces, hopefully. So a good orchestra conductor, like a good CEO, is leading from a balanced kind of place. So when he or she is interacting with one part, they're not forgetting about the other parts. So they're not compromising their relationships with other parts just for the benefit of one. And they keep the unity of the whole in mind just as much as they keep the needs of the individuals. So that's what we end up fostering when we're doing self-leadership with the parts. We differentiate ourselves from the parts. We unblend ourselves. And we start to interact with those parts. The work, by the way, when I'm talking about this, is it can be really new and different for people who aren't used to inner types of exploration. And I think it might be worth saying something about that. Because truth be told, this approach is not for everybody, and it's something that, even though I'm mentioning these things as though it's kind of a fact, in my experience these things are true, I kind of want to suggest and ask people to, you know, you don't have to believe this. You don't have to really buy this, but I want to invite you to try it, or at least be open to some of the concepts, and we'll practice this a little bit tonight, just for a couple minutes, so you get a taste of it. And if it seems true to you, then, you know, take the next step, what I'd encourage you to do. But it can be too good to be true. And what I mean by that is sometimes it's impossible to do inner work. Like for whatever reason, the things that are happening around us, in other words, in the environment, like just, for example, like if you're familiar with meditating, like you're not instructed to meditate while driving, hopefully. Or it's pretty hard to be shooting three-pointers on the basketball court and meditating at the same time. They're really mutually exclusive. So this kind of inner work, it requires a person having time and space and commitment to sitting and listening inside, and patience, the other thing. And frankly, some of us are not wired naturally for that. We process things by talking to somebody else. So there's room for that. What I want to say about that is this approach works in many ways, but I'm speaking tonight primarily about the way that we often work with it internally. So I won't get into the other ways you can use this, but there are other ways to use it. I'm going to talk about, I mentioned the nomenclature and the organization of parts. I want to just mention what I defined a part as a mind-body state. I want to talk about the different types of parts, because I think some of this will make a little bit more sense and will give some more clarity to how this works. The parts, you know, we have any number of parts. We're forming them every day. So part of me, I discovered a part of me, for example, I was, you know, reading these amazing stories that are coming out in the news about the events in Pakistan, and, you know, discovered a part of me I really didn't know was there. Part of me that was kind of, I was hearing an interview with one of the bin Laden family members, and I was kind of shocked to discover a feeling that I was having that was kind of unaware. It's literally, I was unaware, didn't even cross my mind that this guy would have family. So there's a part of me that I just became aware of this week, but that was operating in the background of my mind. It was, you know, making these assumptions about how he presented himself or how he was portrayed, whatever the case, that he's a rogue person, basically a demon that has no humanity to him. So I was kind of shocked to discover, like, being pulled into this person's humanity. And at the same time, the minute I felt that, there was another part of me that said, you know, wait a minute, this guy deserves it, that sort of thing, like that sort of part that wants revenge. So, you know, we have these parts, and we're noticing them all the time. And so that can be disturbing sometimes if you're not familiar with how to tune into and mediate parts of yourself. But at the same time, it can be really fascinating and a lot of fun to discover that. And if you're in a relationship with somebody, it can be really helpful to the other person, because you get to, it's almost like you don't, you get to call yourself on things before the other person has to point it out, which can be a lot nicer than sometimes how it goes otherwise. Give lots of examples, but I won't do that right now. I'm going to mention the different general categories. So, generally speaking, there are parts, the ones that we get to know the most and the ones we think of as ourself, are what we call protective parts. And protectors are organized in two different categories. And I think people will start to relate to these right away. That one category of protectors are called managers. And these are parts of us that try to protect us from pain. All protectors keep us from pain, but managers do that by preventing pain from us experiencing pain in the first place. So they're things like controlling type of attitude or thinking, judging, inner critic, caretaking part, a people-pleasing part, intellectualizing. You know, these are very, oftentimes these are very responsible types of parts, and they're very good at their core. They actually just want to help. But when they're extreme form, they can be symptomatic or cause difficulty. Passive-aggressive parts, avoiding parts, striving parts, procrastinating, defensiveness, distracting. Those are just examples of managers. And managers want to be responsible. They want to prevent bad things from happening. That's the rationale for those parts. They'll say the reason I'm doing this is because I don't want it to be much worse. And if I didn't do this job, if I didn't get so defensive and make such a big scene or a big deal of this, then something bad would happen. And there's usually a specific thing that it's afraid of. And the other category of protectors is firefighters. We call them firefighters. Firefighters, when you think of the analogy that word implies, just like real firefighters. You know, my office one day, my office is located above a restaurant. And restaurant had a chimney fire one day. And sure enough, we had a troop of firefighters coming up into our office, as many of them as could fit in the elevators. And you know, when they came in, they firefighters don't care about the upholstery. They have this thing about them where that's not why they're getting paid, to worry about the footprints and the soot that's on their boots coming through the office. They really don't care. And in fact, if they cared about that stuff, they'd probably get fired, quite literally. Their job is to put the fire out. And so they break stuff, they damage stuff, they flood stuff. That's not their concern. Their concern is to put the fire out. So psychologically speaking, when we talk about parts of us that are firefighters, we have lots of these parts, and it's natural. These are parts that are trying to shut off pain. That's, pain's already out of the, it's already happening. So the fire's already started. We have parts that react to it. They tend to be very impulsive. And like I said, don't really care about the damage as much as the managers. Managers are just the opposite. All they care about is making sure there's no damage and that fire never starts. So as you can imagine, when you have a firefighter that's overacting, you're going to have managers that start overacting and start overreacting to it. We have parts in our systems psychologically. Managers and firefighters are often in these tensions, and that causes us anxiety. It causes us all kinds of physical symptoms and psychological symptoms. So examples, maybe some examples of firefighters' parts would be things like rage, eating. You know, I have parts of me that could eat a bowl of ice cream every time, pretty much any time I'm not feeling well. I'm going to say every day, that's probably true, but especially when I'm not feeling well. So our relationship to food a lot of times will show up in sort of a firefighter type of thing. Sexual acting out, using drugs or alcohol, any kind of addiction, or disassociation, just numbing yourself, just zoning out, daydreaming, falling asleep. So that's what firefighters are doing. Both the firefighters and protectors, I'm sorry, both firefighters and managers are protecting us from pain. And that's the third set of parts that we have, which is the parts that hold the pain. So we call those parts exiles. And exiles are emotions or mind-body states that, you know, you'd know what these are because basically they're ones that you don't want to have around. So they're almost universally shunned and avoided. And people have really negative reactions if you expose these to other people. If somebody sees your exiles, generally there's going to be a reaction unless they're accessing their self. Their parts of them are going to have a negative reaction. They're going to want to get rid of you. So they're going to want to exile you out of fear that you'll flood them with pain also. So some examples of exiles would be loneliness, shame, fear, fear of anger, abandonment, any kind of feeling helplessness, worthlessness, feeling violated, feeling needy, feeling powerless. So those are all things that our protectors are trying to keep out of our consciousness. But a lot of times it doesn't work, and something springs the exiles. We get injured. Our system gets flooded with exiles. And so our protectors go into overdrive. Even though that doesn't bring healing to the exiles, they're doing their best. So firefighters come onto the scene easily addicted or compelled or obsessed with something. We get these managers that are just trying to control people and control everything in our life. Well, really, the activity of the protectors, or the overactivity, can be traced back to the flooding of the exiles. So when we're doing this work, we're keeping all of this in mind. We're not just listening to parts of us and exploring parts just for the fun of it. What we're doing is we're keeping in mind a kind of hierarchy and a system complexity that typically when we can ask the protectors to step aside and you, just the real you, the self that's compassionate and curious, can interact with the exile. You can interact and start to feel the loneliness, the shame, without being afraid of it. You can start to interact with it, and it doesn't flood you anymore. It responds, just like a real person responds. If you start yelling at somebody and criticizing them and saying, why don't you change this? What's wrong with you? You shouldn't be so this or that. The person gets defensive. They resist you. They're trying to protect themselves because you're attacking. If you approach them with a sense of compassion, like saying, you know, I wonder, you know, would you want help with this, if there's another way to do this? So the exiles start to transform. And we find that this happens spontaneously, that without prompting, this kind of healing can happen, that all of us have this capacity. Dick Schwartz, when he was working with people who came from extremely awful trauma situations from their childhood. They were deprived of an incredible amount of humanity and connection to people, love. And it didn't matter. Contrary to some of the most widely held religious and even scientific views about evolution, for example, that even that if you don't get it basically in childhood, then you're never going to get it. You're never going to do this yourself. You got to get it somewhere else. You got to find the right partner, or you got something like that. What we were finding, what Dick was finding, and I found this to be true too, is that spontaneously people, even with these supposedly deprived systems internally, they have a capacity to grow and develop and heal when they're leading their parts. So usually we have to learn, the person does need to learn how to steps of accessing parts and doing it safely. So I'm going to stop here. I've been talking for a while. I'm going to hear from people about questions. Is any of this making sense? What do you need to hear more about?
Pete?
Yes.
This is Ken. Since I am prone to anxiety, I was interested in your comment about intellectualizing as a protector mechanism, as a management mechanism. I was wondering if you could expand on that.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, our intellectual parts, one of the things we do when we're talking about a part, and so if it's an intellectual part, is we're going to get to know how that part works. That's the first thing we're going to do. So what we want to do is I'd be asking you, for example, how do you know it's there? How do you know that intellectual part is there? So we'd be looking at what its job is, Ken. We'd be getting to know how it shows up in your life, and particularly what triggers it, what makes it more active. And we ask this question, whenever we're working with any part, we ask a question, and this is how we know it's protecting something and it's not really your true self. And so, I mean, it's kind of an audacious thing, by the way. I admit, when I was doing this work for the first time, and my therapist said to me, you know, well, that part of you that's talking right now, could that step aside? It was kind of audacious. Like, well, what do you mean? That's me. But the point is that actually it's not truly you. It's a part. It's a pre-programmed thing. And it just so happens that most of us, or all of us, I should say, are dominated by our protectors. That's how we interact with the outside world. Most of the time, we have our way. That's the way we'll keep it. So we ask a question, how you can tell if it's really the true you, in other words, the more kind of universal self, is we ask, well, if you weren't doing that thing, so in this case, if it's intellectualizing, if you weren't doing that, what feelings would be there, or what mind-body states would start to happen? Then usually it's a different, there's another part there. Something else emerges.
Okay, well, so, that's helpful. I guess I was, what I'm gleaning is that the intellectualizing itself is flooding out or occupying space that if, and it might be masking something underneath.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Thanks.
Other questions so far? Going to,
Could you kind of explain what you'll cover? I mean, I know you talked about the topic of the background and the idea of the class. Can you explain what we'll be doing in the 6 weeks and the possible assignments outside of class?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. I'm glad you reminded me about that. The class is, let me just say something about structure and format and answer your question. The class is 6 weeks, 2 hours each week, a total of 12 hours. And during the class, you're going to be reading a book called Self-Therapy by Jay Early. And the book is a kind of a nuts and bolts book, takes you through just the process of working with protectors. We're really not interested in this class in accessing exiles for lots of reasons, but mainly because we don't have the support. You won't have the support. It's not psychotherapy. So what we're doing in the class is just getting you to get to know and get familiar with this concept of, it's a kind of a radical concept. Like I'm saying, you're not who you think you are, basically. In fact, these are protective parts of you that are most of the time operating you. And so you'll be reading the book, and the book is structured by exercises that you'll be doing yourself. So you'll be doing it privately yourself in between classes. And the way it's structured, we hope to have 10 people in the class. We'll need more people to sign up. The way it's structured is that you're in between classes, you're going to be doing some peer facilitation with one other person each week. So you'll have to keep that in mind if that's something you'd be comfortable with. But just to say that the exercises are very structured, and I go over a very clear protocol for maintaining confidentiality and safety so that it's not meant to be, you know, the person that you're going to be working with, it's be by phone, by the way. So I would assign a different person from the group each week, so you work with a different person for between 15 and 30 minutes each week. So very minimum, you would take turns practicing the one specific exercise. For the most part, the exercise would be taking turns following the steps in the book about listening to yourself and sitting and describing what's there, following the steps, asking parts to step aside and describing to the other person what's there. There's a very limited type of facilitation that the other person is doing. So they're not, in other words, a lot of control is built in to make sure, since you don't really know who's going to be in the group, to make sure it stays safe and comfortable for everybody. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Other questions before I want to give you a little demonstration? Just take a few minutes at the end of our time here. Okay. I'll leave a couple minutes at the end, but we've got 10 minutes left here. And you can get to a place where you won't be interrupted, or a place that's quiet. See if you can do that. And if you're not, or you're driving or playing basketball or something, you can listen in. The main thing I want to invite you to do is to go inside yourself. And you can close your eyes if you're comfortable with that. And just start by taking a few breaths and noticing your breathing. I'm going to ask you to bring your attention into your body first. A lot of our parts are located physically somewhere. So we'll start often by just tuning into breathing. And without really doing anything, I just want you to notice the state of your breathing and become kind of a witness, like you're watching. You're the observer. You might notice maybe a tension or stress somewhere in your body. And as you're breathing, noticing whatever's there, just send the message to what you're noticing, that doesn't have to change. It can be doing exactly what it's doing. And you're there just to observe it and listen. Notice how it responds to you. Notice how whatever part of you is noticing. Maybe a distracted part, maybe a part that says, do this very well. I don't like close my eyes or do these exercises. I have a part like that. Whatever it is, it could be a distracted part or a part that has an agenda or a thought, question. Witness it. Send it the message that you're just interested in what it's doing. You're not there to change it or get rid of it or judge it. And you can let that part, give yourself permission to listen to how that part reacts. It might say something. You might actually, almost like hearing, you're hearing a voice respond. Listen to what that is. And you might even ask it, what is it trying to do? Or what does it want? What is it concerned about? We have some parts, by the way, that, you know, these questions I'm guiding you through that don't really respond to. They're not talking parts. They're much more primitive. So if you find that and you're just maybe not getting much of a response or sure if anything's happening, don't worry about it. You might just be noticing a part that's not talking or not very clear. So just we'll let it be doing whatever it's doing. Relax with it. So normally we would continue, after hearing a part, listening into yourself, we would ask that part to step aside. We'd ask it to move over. Sometimes that happens almost like hitting a switch and another part, feeling or mind state emerges. Spontaneously. Other times nothing's really happening. So we go back to the steps of approaching the part and trying to be compassionate with it. Sometimes that triggers another part that says, be compassionate. What am I doing this for? I don't even know what I'm doing or something. So there you found another part, that's concerned about the right thing or something like that. So not hard to find parts. Everywhere you look, there's a part of you. We approach it the same way. We just, when you notice it, respectfully ask it what it's doing, acknowledge it, and almost spontaneously, it usually relaxes. You're doing it with a kind of agenda. Sometimes we get to know parts. We don't know it, but we're blended with another part. Judgment involved and not relaxing because you really want to get to something or find something out. It's a very creative process. It takes some getting used to. It took me a lot of getting used to. I'm not definition. I'm much more a rational, intellectual person than I am artistic, creative. And this calls out the process itself, even though there's a lot of rational stuff to sink your teeth into, a lot of strategic orchestrating you can do, it's still helpful. But the real meat of it is letting the parts start to talk back to you. That's where it's incredibly powerful. So, pause here. Just in the 4 minutes we have left, I just want to make sure people have any if you have a question, to feel free to ask. Didn't cover that. Just clearing. Okay. So we'll conclude our call, the call here, and if you would like to hear the recording of this, feel free to email me and you can get the recording. There's also the manual, which I can email you for each session of the class that we'll be going through, pretty detailed. And so you get an idea of what each lesson would contain. So unless there's anything else, we just want to thank you for being here. And also feel free to be in touch individually. If there's a question you didn't want to ask publicly, feel free to call or email directly.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.